Well, okay, so it's Valentine's Day, our culture's holiday dedicated to love and romance, and it's a celebration that actually dates all the way back to 496, the day that, you know, especially focused on love and marriage. By the way, did you hear that two television antennas met, fell in love, and got married? From what I hear, the wedding ceremony wasn't much, but the reception was excellent. Okay, well, do you know why melons have to get married in a planned church ceremony? They cantaloupe, yes, exactly. Oh, yeah, okay, all right. Stop, I know. Okay, in his book, Flesh and Machines, MIT professor Rodney Brooks says that human beings are really nothing but machines. He says we are, quote, a big bag of skin full of biomolecules that interact by the laws of physics and chemistry and nothing more. That's it, just material stuff. And of course, if that's true, then much of what we think about ourselves wrong. Our lives really have no meaning. There's nothing spiritual about us. There's no such thing as morality. And of course, love is just the product of overheated physical processes, nothing more. All our talk about love and morality bear about the same relation to reality as the little hearts that we see on this day of the year bear to the actual reality of a heart, which is to say, not much. However, Mr. Brooks admits he doesn't operate by his own assertion. He says he can tell himself that his own children are nothing more but machines, but, quote, that is not how I treat them. I interact with them on an entirely different level. They have my unconditional love, the furthest one might be able to get from rational analysis. He admits that he operates and maintains two different sets of inconsistent beliefs. They are machines, but I cannot live that way. And do not believe that way, really. One of the tests that we should apply to our beliefs is the reality test. How do what you believe and their implications for daily living match up with reality? Can you actually live by what you say? If you say human beings are just machines, but you absolutely cannot live that way, doesn't that suggest that perhaps there's something wrong with your analysis? If it doesn't work in the real world, how rational can it be? Can you imagine what the world would be like if there was no such thing as love? Oscar Wilde said, "Life without love is like a sunless garden when the flowers are dead." And you can imagine a picture of a gray day and, you know, dead garden, no flowers, brown, dreary. He says that's what the world would be like without love, but I think he understated it. The truth is that without love, this world would be a horror. It would be hell. So today on Valentine's Day, I thought it would be appropriate for us to think about the subject of love. We're going to take a little break from our study of Thessalonians that we've been doing. In particular, I want you to think especially about marriage relationships. Now, some of you are not married, you're single, and I want you not to check out, because here's the thing, love relationships operate on the same principles, always. So love is love, whether it's married love, parental love, sibling love, friendship love, the same principles apply in every situation, and so there's much that we can all learn about our love relationships, our friendships, our families, just through thinking about love, and especially its implications on marriage. In fact, one of the fundamental errors that people in our culture make is to fail to realize that marriage at its core is a friendship. And if it's not a friendship at its core, it's never going to work. So we all need to think about love, no matter where we are in life. And I want to take some thoughts today from a familiar passage. It's in 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. Which says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. So if we know him, we're going to love. That's his implication. So we're going to think about love. The first question when you think about love is, why should we care about it? It seems an obvious thing. I mean, we all do care about it. But I mean, why should we care about love and marriage especially? Well, if you're a follower of Jesus, and I know most of you are, probably all of you, this passage gives us all the reason we should ever need. Verse 7 says, let us love one another. That is a command. It's not a suggestion. It's not a recommendation. It is a command. It's an order. You know, when Michael's commanding officer gives him an order, he doesn't say, Michael doesn't say, yeah, you know, that's an interesting thought. Let me give it some thought. Let me think about it, and I'll get back to you. Yes, sir. You obey an order. We've been given, as followers of Jesus, an order here. Love one another. Yes, sir. We obey. That's all the reason we would ever need. Jesus himself in John 13, verse 34 is all we're going to look at. A new command I give you, he said, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know you are my disciples if you love one another. Jesus said, love one another like I love you. And that begins, if you're married, with your spouse. Love isn't limited to your spouse, but it sure should start there. Going all the way back to Genesis 2, God says the marriage relationship has got to be the priority above all else. Here's the thing about marriage. It has a purpose. You know, the ultimate purpose of marriage is not to produce children. It's not to provide an appropriate and healthy outlet for your sexual urges. It is not even so that you can be fulfilled and satisfied. Marriage should accomplish all those things and involve all those things, but the ultimate purpose of marriage, according to the scriptures, is revealed in John 5:32, where Jesus said it is to be a picture of God's love for his people. You know, I confess that I have a soft, chewy center, meaning I'm ridiculously sentimental. And it really got bad once we had kids. I was sentimental before them. After we had kids, man, it just got bad. And as I've gotten old, it's just gotten exponentially worse. And, I think my daughter-in-law, Anna, kind of revels in seeing me cry. She thinks it's hilarious. I think she likes to do things just that, oh, watch him, he's crying again, you know. One of the things that I'm dismayed by is how movies even can cause me to cry. Lori has been on the warpath to try to make Toby and me watch the movie The Notebook. And because neither of us have seen it, neither of us wants to see it. And she says, Rick, I know you'll cry if you watch it. It's like, yes, I will. I will cry for the loss of my manhood, you know. Field of Dreams. I weep every time I see it. Ask Lori. There's some places it's just, and the dad, you know. Man, oh man. Here's the thing. Why do we cry at just watching a pretend story? People are pretending to do something, and they're designed to make us cry, and I cry. That tells you about the potential of a movie, of seeing a story acted out, which is exactly what God says he wants our marriages to be. Here's the purpose of your marriage. It's to be like a movie that people watch and are touched by. It reaches them at a level they can't even really understand because they long desperately to see love lived out in our world. You know what? People want that badly. We saw that. I've mentioned this before. We saw that on the day that Michael and Carissa got married. Before the ceremony, they got married on the beach in front of the Hotel Del. And before the ceremony, the photographers took pictures of both of them. And Lori and I actually accompanied the photographers and Carissa as she walked around to different locations in the hotel to get her picture taken. And as everywhere we went, everywhere, everyone who saw her would smile. And they'd get this big grin on their face. They'd almost always say something. They'd say, oh, congratulations. And they were just happy to see a bride. When the ceremony was over, we walked off the beach back past a swimming pool. And the people at the pool that we have never met started clapping and cheering. Why? Because people long for marriage and love to work. There's something deeply embedded in us that says we want that. And so God says what they're really longing for is to experience his unconditional love. And so he says, I want you to give them a picture of it, that it's real and alive in this world, and it's to happen between a husband and wife. And that is the purpose of a marriage between two followers of Jesus Christ. So God orders us, love one another, beginning with your spouse. Now, there's an interesting thing. Not only is this important because it is fulfilling God's real desire for marriage, but it's also because we desperately need it. We are created with an enormous, endless, built-in need to love and be loved. That's what it means to be human. We're created in the image of God, and the Christian faith is unique in all of the world, of all the world's religion, because it has a triune God. One being existing somehow in a way that we can't understand as three persons, which means that within his own character, his own being, God experiences relationship. Relationship is a part of who God is. It's part of his character. We have been created in the image of God, which means relationship is embedded in who we are. We are only fully human when we are in relationship, when we are experiencing love, loving and being loved. We need it to be human. And we know we have this unquenchable need for relationship. We feel it. There will never be a time when you'll hear a person say, well, you know what? That's all the love I need. I've been loved up to my max. I'm good. I'm done for the rest of my life. I've got all I need. That will never, ever happen. Have you ever noticed that even the Lone Ranger wasn't alone? He had Tonto. Why? Because alone is not good. Got to have a buddy. You know, Lori and I went with Michael and Carissa to see the new Star Wars movie. Toby and Anna had seen it on opening day. We babysat for them. So we've all seen the movie. Well, Toby, a couple weeks later, wanted to go see it again. He wanted to see it in IMAX. Okay, but Anna said, you know what? I want to stay home with the baby. So I volunteered to go with Toby to see the movie. So we went, we saw it. And both of us came away from it saying, you know what? I think we enjoyed it more the second time than we did the first time. Well, Loria said, I want to go see it again. Go ahead, you can go see it again, you know? You know what? She doesn't want to go see it by herself. Why doesn't she want to go see it alone? Because life is about sharing. It's only worth going to see if I can go see it with someone I love, with my husband. We're created for that. So we should all care about love because we care about love. Even if we don't think we do, we do. So here's the question. We all care about love. What's amazing is that everybody's in favor of love, and yet there's really not nearly enough love in this world, is there? We all seem to have this strange ability to be totally in favor of love, totally committed to love, and then not love. So here's the question. What erodes love? What causes relationships to degrade and maybe not be what they ought to be? Well, there are a number of factors, but I'm going to mention two that I think are significant today. And the first one is just failure of effort. Tim and Kathy Keller in their book, The Meaning of Marriage, wrote, marriage won't work unless you put your spouse and your marriage first. Here, this is the principle. Any love relationship, any friendship is going to require effort. And marriage, because it is the pinnacle of relationship, requires the pinnacle of effort. It was funny, you know, Lori and I recently watched on demand the movie The Intern, a new movie with Robert De Niro and was Anne Hathaway, was that it? I think, anyway. Not a great movie, but I observed something interesting about the story in it. Anne Hathaway plays this woman who starts this online clothing business and it just takes off and in less than 2 years explodes. It's become this huge operation and she's extremely successful, and Robert De Niro comes on as a senior intern. Long story, but the interesting thing I noticed about it is that it gave sort of a tip of a cap to the need for there to be some effort, that some level family relationships are important. But the core message of the movie was, well, above all else, this woman needs to fulfill her calling as a successful businesswoman. That's the most important thing. And everything else needs to orient around that. And that's the consistent message you will always see from Hollywood. Oh, the career, self-fulfillment, that's what comes first. No, it doesn't. In fact, that's why in Hollywood, marriages seem to be a disposable item. They can't make it work. Because if it's going to work, marriage has to be the first priority. I think of marriage, really any love relationship, as being like a crackling fire in a fireplace on a cold night. You know, there's something about that that's just appealing, isn't there? You know, it warms both the body and the soul. You know, there's just something beautiful about that fire that it just makes you feel good and it's nice and warms you up. And it's great in a cold night. But here's the thing about a fire. What happens if you ignore it? It dies, doesn't it? It goes out. The only way you can keep a fire burning is by continuing to feed it and fuel it and tend it. And that's exactly the same thing that is true of marriage relationships and of any love relationship. They bring us warmth. They warm our souls in a cold world. But man, if you just ignore them, they're going to die out. You have to expend energy. You got to put out effort to keep romance alive, which is to say to keep love alive. And this is a big challenge for some of us, especially when days like Valentine's Day roll around. We poor guys who by and large are not overly blessed with a sense of the romantic are faced with a conundrum. You know, what do I do that's romantic? What's a gift that's romantic? For you guys, here are a couple of rules of thumb. If it's cool, it's not romantic. It's an important, you know, high-powered rifles, they're not romantic. Tickets to a Los Angeles Kings hockey game, not romantic. Cool, really cool, not romantic. Anything to do with fighter jets or football, really cool, not romantic. So if it's cool, it's not romantic. Secondly, if it's practical, it's not romantic. You know, new iron and ironing board. It's practical, not romantic. Hey, how about a new set of screwdrivers? Well, practical, not romantic. How about a necklace? Completely impractical. What does a necklace do? It doesn't do anything. Therefore, it's romantic. There you go, guys. Now you know. So here's the thing. For guys, in order to tend the fire, that's going to mean learning lessons like that. What does it mean? What touches my wife's soul? One of the most important things you can do to tend that fire is listen. Oh, man. Listen to your spouse, to your friend. And by that, you know, I got to tell you that that can be a challenge, you know. Lori is a very open person, and she's very communicative. She wants me to know whatever's going on in her head. And you know what? That's a great thing because I don't have to end up guessing. which is really a problem. You know, when guys, sometimes when you have that thing where it's like, okay, now I got to guess, what's the problem here? Lori's always just out there, and that's really great. But what comes with that is she kind of has this stream of consciousness communication style. It's just, you know, stuff, whatever she's thinking, it's just coming at you, you know, all the time. And that's great, except that there are times when, you know, maybe I'm reading the newspaper, and so she says something, and okay, we talk, and we have a conversation, and it's over, and I start reading, and I'm reading, and all of a sudden, I realize she's talking again. You know, there's words, uh-oh, I missed something, you know. You know what? It takes effort to say, I'm gonna stop, and I'm going to listen. And by listening, I don't even just mean hearing the words. I mean hearing the heart behind the words. Listening means seeking to understand not just what your spouse or your friend is saying, but what they're feeling, but what matters to them, what's important, what's going on in their lives. Listen, hear. It's a hugely important way to tend the fire. The other part of the communication process is also a critically important part of tending the fire, and that is being wise and loving in what you say. Proverbs 18:21, one of the most powerful verses in all of Scripture, says, "The tongue has the power of life and death. And those who love it will eat its fruit." Your tongue, your words, can give life to your spouse, and they can just destroy them. Ephesians 4:29 says, "We should only say what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen." Man, there is a powerful way of tending the fire. The world is not shy about revealing our faults and telling us that we don't measure up. It does that in a lot of ways. And many of us have heard, you know, negative stuff from the time we were young. And over time, we accumulate an awful lot of verdicts that get passed against us by others and even by ourselves. We condemn ourselves. Here's the amazing thing. A loved one, especially a spouse, has the opportunity to see a partner with all of their faults better than anyone else. And when that person then expresses appreciation and affirmation anyway, that has tremendous power. Tim Keller says that he was something of a nerd in his younger years. He was uncool, did all the uncool things. And as a result, he said, you know, as a kid, he was often excluded from the in-group and even from a lot of events. He says it's interesting that his wife, Kathy, has continually told him that though the world might see him being like Clark Kent, she knows that underneath, he's got on his blue underwear. You know? He says she points out and celebrates every tiny, courageous thing he does. And he says, bit by bit, over the years, her message has sunk in. He says this, "To my wife, I'm Superman, and it makes me feel like a man in a way that nothing else could." Truth is, I can inflict great pain and harm on Lori simply by thoughtless, insensitive, selfish, or harsh words. And she can do the same to me. All she needs to do is lash out with impatience or disgust or frustration or pointing out one of my many faults, and man, she can do incredible damage, drive a huge wedge between us. Fortunately for me, instead, she has lavished me for 36 years with just praise and affirmation. And it has an interesting effect on me. It makes me want to live up to what she says she believes about me. It makes me profoundly grateful for her. Psychologist John Gottman is one of the leading experts on what makes a successful marriage. And he's an amazing guy that can analyze interactions between husbands and wives for less than 5 minutes and can predict accurately how successful their relationship will be. He says one of the key things he looks for is how much affirmation he sees between a couple. How much affirmative interaction takes place tells you almost everything about how successful that relationship is going to be. So here's a question for you. How are you tending the fire of your marriage? What are you doing on a consistent basis to feed the fire? How are you serving the one you love in real and practical ways? How are you making that person feel cherished above all else? What are you doing to express your love to your spouse? What extraordinary thing have you done recently to show them how much you appreciate them? If you don't have any answers to those questions, you're doing damage to your relationship. It's time to get to work. Start tending the fire. So that's the first thing. Second thing that erodes love is living for self. And on Luke 9:23, after warning his disciples that he was going to be executed eventually, Jesus said this. These are words you're probably familiar with. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Deny himself. Say no to self to follow me. In those words, Jesus laid a stark choice before us. You can be a follower of Jesus, but to do so means denying yourself, saying, I'm not going to live for myself. So you can follow Jesus and say no to self, or you can say yes to self. I'm going to live for myself. I'm going to take care of me. In which case, you're denying Jesus. You're saying no to him. And we need to understand that when we say, I'm going to live my life so that it suits me, you are saying to Jesus, no, I'm not doing what you want me to do. I'm doing what I want to do. And that choice is the choice that has been the source of all of the evil that has ever been experienced in this world. In his marriage seminar, Paul Tripp says that every moment of every day, we must choose which kingdom we're going to serve. Am I going to serve my kingdom? It's all about me. I'm going to take care of me. I've got to make sure that I feel good and that my demands and my needs are met and that I'm built up. Or are we going to live for God's kingdom and say it's all about honoring God? And the way I do that is by serving him, glorifying him, and loving his people, beginning with my spouse. My kingdom or his kingdom? It's that choice. And we have to make that choice every single day. Did you notice in Luke 9:23? Must deny himself and take up his cross daily. Wouldn't it be great if we stood before an altar on our wedding day and we said, I'm going to love you and I'm going to cherish you and serve you for the rest of my life, and that was the last time we ever had to make that choice? Wouldn't that be great? That's not how it works, is it? You say that day, I'm making you a promise to do that, and then you have to fulfill that promise every day of your life from that day forward. The greatest threat to love, intimacy, and friendship, the greatest threat to our marriage, is when we live for our own kingdom. The problem is that marriage, and particularly, offers boundless opportunities for us to make that choice to live for our kingdom and not God's. That's because it consists of countless little interactions between two flawed, sinful human beings who are both inherently addicted to self. Recently, one evening, we were in the kitchen. We were getting ready for dinner, and I was really thirsty, so I grabbed a glass and had some water and drank it, and I realized, oh, I just drank out of Lori's glass. I said, oh, Lori, I'm sorry, I just drank out of your glass. She said, that's all right, I used your toothbrush this morning. Oh, you know, this is married life, you know. Stuff like this goes on all the time. These interactions take place day after day, and they challenge us with this choice. For me or for God's kingdom, loving you. We had a recent interaction where Lori had had a really busy day, and we were getting ready for dinner, and she's kind of stressed, and so I thought, I'm going to help out here, you know, and I don't even remember exactly what I was trying to do, but I was trying to help out, and Lori said, Rick, you know what, don't do that. That's not going to go well. I said, oh, no, I got this, you know, and, well, I didn't have it. I ended up making a huge mess, and she said, Rick, that's why I told you not to do that. I knew this was going to happen, and you know, just that reaction, that sort of, she was a little frustrated with me because she knew it was going to happen. She told me not to do it. I went ahead and did it, and, you know, it went bad. And she said, I told you, why did you do that? Just that reaction engendered me an instant reaction inside. You know what that's like, that I'm hurt? Well, I was just trying to help. You know, I wanted to be defensive. Wanted to say, well, you know, something, I don't know, but you're blaming me and I'm trying to be good, you know, kind of, and all of a sudden I was just feeling all that and went, whose kingdom are you living for here? Can I get back to you on that, you know? okay, I'm going to live for God's kingdom. Yeah, you're right, I'm sorry, I messed up, I should have listened, you were right. We have it happen all the time. You know, poor Lori. I feel bad for her. You should too. She has to live with me, you know. So many irritations. For instance, I've mentioned this before. I'm a real connoisseur. When it comes to food, my favorite meals are not necessarily in this order, a really good hamburger and fries, pizza, Mexican food without cilantro, my mom's fried chicken and mashed potatoes and gravy, and Lori's macaroni and cheese. Those are definitely my favorite. Let me ask you, whose diet does that sound like? Sounds like a 10-year-old, doesn't it? I mean, isn't that what a 10-year-old? Yeah, pizza, burgers, we're good, you know. And poor Lori, you know, this is what, and so she tries every now and then, you know, she wants to be creative. I'm going to do something creative. And every time she tries to do something creative meal-wise, she knows what's going to happen. I'll be a good Boy Scout. I'll eat it, and I'll try to be good, but I just don't like it. And she knows that's going to happen. It's so frustrating for her. And she just soldiers on. You know, and to make matters worse, there's the problem of my favorite sauce for food, ketchup. I love ketchup. My favorite by far. And, you know, and I'm not talking about the, you know, you go someplace and they try to give you the organic or the gourmet stuff. Forget that. The real stuff, Heinz 57 varieties, that's what I like, you know. The problem is, go to my favorite meal, hamburger, french fries, slathered in ketchup. Lori knows every time it happens, the food is not the only thing that's going to end up with ketchup on it. There will be ketchup on my clothes somewhere every single time. And she's got, you know, these things are irritating. It's why, you know, my husband, we've been married for almost 37 years. Isn't it time you can eat without spilling on yourself, you know? And yet, she continually offers not criticism, not disgust, not frustration, but love and patience. And that makes a huge difference. She's saying no to the things that might be difficult for her and inconvenient for her and saying, I don't care about that. I'm going to love you. This is countercultural and utterly unnatural for human beings because something within us screams, what about me? What about what I want? And the yelling is so loud at times that we can't hear anything else. But remember Paul's profound description of love in 1 Corinthians 13? In verse 5, the heart of it, he says this, love does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Man, if we could just memorize that verse and then apply it every day of our lives, it would be revolutionary. Doesn't dishonor a spouse. No, it honors the spouse continually. It affirms. It does not easily angered. Boy, you can't get this person mad for anything. And doesn't keep a record of wrongs. And I remember a couple said, hey, we've been having some problems in our marriage. We want to come see you. Oh, okay. Came in. They start talking. I said, so what seems to be the problem? And they started off with the latest little brouhaha that they had had. And within 5 minutes, they were angrily firing at each other over things that had happened 15 years earlier. I let them go for a while, and then I said, oh, okay, could hold it right there. I said, you're talking about these things that have gone and happened 15 years ago. Listen to 1 Corinthians 13:5. It says, love keeps no record of wrongs. So how are you relating to one another? Is this love? Now, not only were they mad at each other, they were also mad at me. Now, so, but come on, you know, you've been keeping a long, long record of stuff, and you use it as ammunition. That's not love. And then he says, love is not self-seeking. The truth is that whoever your spouse or your friend is, that person is going to present you with countless opportunities to be impatient, to be annoyed, to be disappointed, to be hurt. If you're looking for them, if you're looking for those kind of things, you'll find them in abundance. And even if you're not, you'll experience them. Here's the thing. Love doesn't track those things. Love says, I'm not about that stuff. I'm about giving to you. I promised when we got married that I would love you till the day we die. And love means I don't keep track of those wrongs. And love means I don't seek my things. I don't care about me. I'm here to love you. Not about me. It's about loving you. So here's the question. How can we love like that? This kind of love is frightening to us almost because we think of totally letting go of self and expending our lives to care about another person, and something inside us just keeps whimpering, they're going to take advantage of me and my needs are going to be ignored and I'm going to treat as unimportant, it's going to feel like death. Is it really feasible to choose to live for God's kingdom and to love unselfishly like that? Here's the question. Remember, we'll go back to what I said at the very beginning. We need to apply the reality test to our beliefs. If our beliefs are what this passage we're looking at today are true, that God is love and God orders us to love as he loves, if that bears no relation to reality, what do we have? You know, if it doesn't produce true love in our loves and our marriage relationships, then one of two things must be true. Either what we believe is false. Either there is no God, or certainly is not a God of love. Or we don't really believe it. It's got to be one of those two things if it doesn't come out in reality. Yeah, you know, here's where we run into that problem of I believe it, but man, it's hard to live that way. Ephesians chapter 3, verses 16 through 19. Paul prayed that God would strengthen you with power through his spirit in your inner being. That's the first thing we need to be able to love like that, the power of God's spirit. How do we experience that? Well, Paul said in Romans 1, 16, that the gospel of grace is the power of God. That's where we begin experiencing this power of God's Spirit. When we begin to experience God's grace, God's love, unconditional love given to us, such mercy, such kindness, such love, it fills us with gratitude, humility, and a passion to respond to God's love, and we do that by loving one another. That's where God's power begins to come alive, where his Spirit begins to work in our inner being. And then in verse 19, Paul prayed that we might know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to all the measure of the fullness of God. That's an interesting statement. No love that surpasses knowledge. What he means by that is you're never going to be able to comprehend fully God's love. It's too vast for us to be able to measure it and say, oh, yeah, I know how great it is. But he says you can still know it in the idea of experiencing it. And Paul says, that's what I want, that you would experience God's love to the degree that it would begin to become your reality. You would experience being so loved by God that you can't help but have that love begin to fill you and spill over to other people. In our passage in 1 John 4:7, John said that love comes from God. He's the source of it. Every bit of love we have ever experienced that originated with God. And now, he says, we can live in his love, and that love can so fill our hearts that it becomes the dominant thing that is in us. Just like we might say, God is love, so we might say then, Rick Myatt is love. Wouldn't that be great? You know, maybe you remember you were here on September 8th, 2011. Remember that day? It was the day of the great blackout. You know, one employee in Arizona made a mistake and caused a cascade of events that wiped out all of the power in San Diego County and up into South Orange County. And what a mess it was. Boy, that was so frustrating, wasn't it? You know, you went to turn on a light, hit the light switch, and nothing happened. Oh, man, what's wrong with you, light switch? And turn on the television, want to watch television. Oh, it doesn't come on because there's no power. You know, that's what happens to us. When we get in a situation where to have a real, true, intimate love relationship, a marriage, for instance, and we try to love on our own, we experience that kind of a power blackout because to make it work requires a love that we don't inherently have within us. It requires a denial of self that is unnatural to us. And we need some other source of power to resolve the blackout of love in our lives. That source is God's love. The more reality there is in our experience of God's love for us and our understanding of his magnificent, unconditional, eternal, infinite love, the more that we will begin to turn that love onto other people. The most romantic thing that you can do is to be filled with God's love. You know, we can manage unselfish love for brief spurts. You know, the young man who falls madly in love with his, you know, beloved, he can't, there's nothing he would not do for her. He will go anywhere for her. The problem is that studies show that kind of rush of emotional and romantic love lasts a maximum of anywhere from 18 months to 3 years. And then that fades away. And then what do you have? You have a need to tend the fire with unconditional love, unselfish love, the love of God. So when the fervor of romance dies out, as it will, only God's overflowing love can truly fill our hearts to the point where we keep saying, I'm not here for my kingdom, I'm here for God's kingdom, and that means I love you with an unconditional, undying love, and I'm here to serve you, to affirm you, to build you up, to care for you, to be patient with you, to be kind to you, no matter what. And it is that love that will build a blazing fire that will never die out. Let's pray. Father, we are humbled by your love and so very, very thankful for it. And we realize once again that it is, in fact, the source of the love that we long to have. We all experience this desire to really know what it means to love and to be loved, to have a relationship of love that just is glorious and fulfilling and beautiful. Our hearts are drawn to that, Father. You've built that into us. But we also recognize now that we see that it's not natural for us to be able to have that because it requires such unselfishness, such sacrifice, such true unconditional love. So, Father, we start with recognizing that this is what we want. And committing ourselves to this is what we want to build. And then being filled with your love, your unconditional love, to receiving the love that comes from you and then passing it on to our spouses and our friends, loving as you have loved us.